This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. It'll be a quiet holiday season this year, perfect for settling into a good book. Today, we're talking about the new memoir from former Indiana Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, An Examined Life, The John Mutz Story. And we're live today, so if you have questions or comments for our guests, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. What do you remember about the time John Mutz spent in office as Lieutenant Governor? By the way, you can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. We need your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app, All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Today, of course, we have former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, who was also president of the Lilly Endowment in the late 80s, early 90s. He was also president of PSI Energy, the state's largest utility at that time, and a host of other titles we don't have time to get to right now. John Mutz, welcome back to All In.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be with you.
Also joining us is John's co-author, historian and chair of the History and Political Science Department at the University of Indianapolis, Edward Frantz. Welcome to you.
Thank you, Matt. Thrilled to be here.
So, John, had you been wanting to write a memoir for a while?
That's a funny way to put it, because I had the ambition to do it for quite a long time ago. But the problem is I hadn't developed the discipline to really get started. And so what happened was my wife's niece, who is a professional writer, said to me one day, "John, you ought to write a book about your life." And I said, "Well, that's great. I'd like to do that. Would you help me?" And so she did. She sat with me for, I would say, 20 hours, in which we talked about things that had happened in my life and things that had happened to me. And she took notes, and then the notes were put in a notebook. And they were actually put in the notebook by category. And that became the original outline for the book. Now, the truth is that because of my work with Kathy, she was my co-author on Fundraising for Dummies, which is the other book that I've been involved in. Because she provided the discipline and the know-how in that case, I knew I really needed a similar kind of co-author in this case. And I had originally gone to Jim Madison, who is kind of the dean of historians in Indiana, and asked him if he would consider working with me. He said, "Well, I'm too busy on the bicentennial for Indianapolis," but he gave me the names of three bright young historians. And Ted Frantz was one of those. And we got together and developed a collaboration. Having Ted involved was immensely important because he was available to do the things that historians do, to check facts, to check dates, to check names, check spellings and things of that kind. And he also is a very good writer in his own right. Ted and I met and talked about it. And Ted, why don't you tell the story of what happened then?
Yeah, what was next, Ted?
Well, yeah, thank you, John. I mean, it was just fortuitous to have Jim Madison, who is just such a tremendous asset to the whole state, recommend me. And basically, when we met, at first, I wasn't sure this was kind of the task that I could do. Primarily, my writing background had been in 19th century political history, what some call the boring railroad presidents. That's my specialty. But I also, through work at the University of Indianapolis, where I head the Institute for Civic Leadership and Mayoral Archives, there was a real affinity there because of materials from then Mayor Dick Lugar and Bill Hudnut. Those were kind of the peak of John's years. So we would sit down, and certainly the outline that John already had, a lot of those chapters that he had proposed before I even were there, that he had proposed with Kathy, became chapters in the book. But as we started talking, we realized there were all kinds of other ways to go about just all the remarkable stories that he's been involved in. And in some ways, I feel like we've only touched on about a third or a half of them in the book that we were able to publish.
Well, and Ted, there was something, I guess, if we could dig into the book now, I mean, there was something unique about one of the first chapters you wrote together. I understand there's a parallel there with the new president-elect.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that as we sat down here to think about it, one of the things that John told me about is that, well, he's a stutterer. And obviously, when he was in office, there wasn't the movie King's Speech or some of the other sort of cultural references that a broader public could understand. And John opening up about that story, which, of course, is better told by John, I think was a really sort of open way to start the book and to talk about what a struggle it was. And at the same time, when I read the piece, when Biden was on the campaign trail, you know, you collaborate with somebody. And I read this extensive piece where they first had outlined why Joe Biden appeared to pause so much. And unlike John, up to that point in time, Joe Biden had said that he didn't have a stutter, that he once had one, but he was over it. And so that ended up being, you know, a real piece of vulnerability for Joe Biden. And when I shared the piece with John, we had this great conversation, as so often happened. Any of these current events, you play them through John and you get five stories that are just full of detail in life that just are just so remarkable.
John, there is a vulnerability that's necessary there. Was it difficult talking about that?
I would have to say that the idea of putting it in the book was really Catherine Murray's. In one of her early suggestions, she said, the stuttering politician, a curse or a blessing. And we changed that some when we wrote the book, but she's the one who inspired me to talk about it. And the other thing that inspired me to talk about it were the young people who had come to me when I was in office and who said, we understand you stutter. As a matter of fact, we hear you stutter. And of course, the fact is that other stutterers really know when you stutter. They pick up on it right away. The average individual might not do that. And I remember I agreed to speak to a group of young people who stutter and who actually did a camp on the subject. And at the end of this meeting, this one guy said to me, one young man, he said, now, Lieutenant Governor, I'm going to listen to your next speech, and I'm going to count how many times you stutter. No pressure, of course. and so we did that, and he called me back, and he said, you only stuttered twice in 30 minutes. Now, I'm not sure whether anybody in the audience knew I stuttered or not, but I did, and this young man did. Well, it's that kind of personal interchange with people who deal with this issue that made me want to write about it. The other thing was that one of my colleagues in government happened to be a Democrat, and of course I'm a Republican, also stuttered. And what happened, of course, was that while we couldn't agree on much of anything, we could agree on the details of how you deal with stuttering. That person was Julia Carson, who later was a congressman from central Indiana, and there are Carson names on all kinds of buildings and things around downtown Indianapolis now. And Julia had a very difficult stutter, worse than mine, or at least worse in those days than mine. And I can remember times when she'd get up to speak to the Indiana Senate. I was the presiding officer in the chair, and she said, I just got to stop. I can't do it. And she'd pause for a couple of, which seemed like a long time, really probably 15 or 25 seconds, and then she'd get back at it again. So having experienced those kinds of involvement with people kind of inspired me to go ahead and write about it. And I'd have to say that the movie we reference in the book also inspired me because I've seen it twice, and I share the anxiety that other people who stutter have.
And Ted, is that the King's Speech?
Yes, correct. Yep.
Yeah. And I mean, Ted, I don't know, when you're writing with someone about something as personal as that, how did you capture John's feelings about that?
Well, we did a lot. We sat down face to face a lot. Fortunately, we could have collaborated during a global pandemic via the phone, but it sure is nice to be able to do that face to face.
Indeed.
And so generally we'd have an outline and I'd ask some questions and then we'd write and we'd rewrite. And then if we thought we might need some more details, we'd do that. John talked about breathing exercises, for instance, and really that the key for John to cracking that was as a kid, he and a childhood friend were involved in a magic act. And part of that was what he calls a patter. And in that, they had a set routine. And so he realized when he knew the script, essentially, he could get through it. And that was that combined with some other things helped unlock things for John. But again, it's like trying to recapture, okay, where would that have been? Where were you in school? And trying to think through some of those details, which, again, if you are trained the way I was, especially when I was in graduate school, being able to ask somebody those questions directly was just such a blessing and so fascinating.
We are talking today with Ted Frantz, who is a historian and the co-author, along with former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz, of a new memoir called An Examined Life. And we will be back with our guests after a quick break. And coming up, we will talk about setting the groundwork for letting IUPUI come into being, and then also the enactment of Unigov, where Indianapolis and the Marion County governments were sort of fused together, along with all of the other accomplishments that are mentioned in the book. I'm sure we won't get all to every piece of it this hour. If you have questions or comments for the show, we would love to hear from you. We're on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881, and give us your name and where you're calling from and your quick question or comment. We'll do our best to get it into the conversation today. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store and send us your question or comment that way, and we'll try to get it into the show. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. Matt Pelser. Today we're joined by former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz and his co-author, historian Ted Frantz from the University of Indianapolis, and we're talking about the new memoir, An Examined Life, The John Mutz Story. We would love your questions and comments for this hour. What do you remember about John Mutz's time as Lieutenant Governor? Or maybe you remember his gubernatorial campaign in 1988. We're getting to that, and we would love to inject your perspective into that part of the conversation coming up. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. So, John, one of the chapters talks about how IUPUI came into being. What was your hand in that?
I would start by saying that I was a part of a major political movement, real upheaval, if you want to call it that, in Marion County politics. I was a member of the so-called Republican Action Committee that decided that it was time for Republicans in Indianapolis to change things and to win. And so our goal was to create a new organization and to replace the county chairman at that time, Dale Brown, by a new county chairman. And so what happened was this political movement started in an effort to create a new Republican Party with its eye on the future, with candidates who were forward-looking and who had diverse backgrounds. Now, included in that group of people, for example, would be Dick Lugar, who was our candidate for mayor a year later after the first Action Committee election. It would include Bill Ruckelshaus, who later gained fame as one of the participants in the Saturday Night Massacre during the Nixon administration. It included Dick Given, who was a member of the House with me when I was there, and then later went on to become Chief Justice of the Indiana Supreme Court. Ray Crow, the legendary basketball coach of Crispus Attucks High School, was one of our members and a member of the House at the time. So what happened was our goal was to take over, and we in fact did. We elected all of our legislative candidates. The governorship was up for election at the same time, and Ed Whitcomb from Seymour was elected in that campaign. And in addition, as it all turned out, Republicans controlled the House, the Senate in the legislature, the city council, and the county council in Indianapolis. And so after we had won this election in 1968, we said, well, what do we do now? You know, this is kind of like the question asked in the movie, The Candidate. They get elected and they didn't expect to. Well, we expected to. And so we gathered, and one of the early meetings that took place was held at the home of John Burkhart on the west side of Indianapolis. And the purpose of that meeting was to achieve one of our ideas for the future. And that was an independent research grant, university in Indianapolis. At that time, all there was in that category in the public realm was an extension from IU, an extension from Purdue. And what we did, of course, was we decided to draft a bill which would create a University of Indianapolis. That was the title. And our goal was to have a separate board of trustees, separate budget item, all that sort of thing. So it would become a brand new institution. And so we gathered at John Burkhart's house, and there were 10 of us who came together. And I might mention who they were just as a matter of reference and history. Bert Servais, the president of the county council, Tom Hasbrook, the president of the city council, Carl Dortch, the president of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce, L. Keith Bulin, the Republican county chairman who led this political change, John Walls, the deputy mayor, Dick Lueger, the recently elected mayor of Indianapolis. And that's the group, except for three legislators. Ned Lampkin in the House, and Larry Borst, who was in the House then, later became a member of the Senate, and John Mutz. That was the group that gathered. We later added two lawyers, Lou Bowes and Charlie Whistler, both very well-known names in the Indianapolis legal community, who joined us and became the draftsmen of the things that we wanted to get done. Well, anyway, we called this meeting, and the purpose was to talk about this new educational institution. And at the very end of the meeting, Dick Lueger began to comment about some of the challenges of the future, and he talked about how hard it was to get things done in Marion County because there was not any centralized authority. And out of that came a conversation about metropolitan government as practiced in other parts of the country, ranging all the way from New York City to Jeffersonville, I guess it is in Florida. And so at the end of that meeting, we said, well, you know, it might be good to unify government in Marion County. It's kind of a casual conversation, not realizing how complicated and how difficult it would be to get that done. So that's where the inspiration came from, and it was a situation in which we met on Sunday evenings for dinner and a little glass of wine, and then we talked what we wanted to pass. And there were a number of other pieces of legislation, but the key ones that came from the Burkhart meetings were UNIGOV, as it was later called, and the University of Indianapolis. Now, what happened was that there are no secrets in politics, and somebody had figured out that we were talking about a new university, And of course, the leadership at Lafayette and Bloomington got wind of this. And of course, they got concerned because they saw the largest market for higher education in the state, that is Marion County and central Indiana, maybe going someplace else rather than going to the two of them. And so we introduced this bill. We had private conversations with the presidents of the two universities, and suddenly they were meeting and they decided to merge and formed a new university in Indianapolis. And then they had a big problem deciding what to call it. Each of them wanted their own name on it. And the net result was Indiana University, Purdue University at Indianapolis. And of course, people playfully dubbed that Ooey Pooey. And even today, a number of people say that. Well, what happened was we didn't expect them to move that fast because we wanted to pass this bill and get the kind of independent institution we wanted. And they suddenly had a press conference about halfway through the session and said, we have agreed to merge. And it was a really startling change. And it was in part what we wanted, but it really wasn't what we really wanted. That is the independent institution. And the result of all this, of course, is that IUPUI began to grow on what was then called the University Quarter. Bert Servais, as chairman of the county council, had asked the plan commission to set aside all of that territory from a zoning and planning standpoint for higher education. And of course, the IU Law School, the IU Medical School, the IU Dental School, and the hospitals connected to that activity were already there. So that became the site on which we wanted to place this university. And that's the site on which IU and Purdue leadership decided to put their institution. Purdue at that time had a major investment on East 38th Street across from the state fairgrounds, and IU had installations in downtown buildings. So that's really how IUPUI came into being. And then over the years, those of us who continued to serve in one way or another made sure that every year in the state budget, there was enough money to allow IUPUI to acquire additional ground in the university quarter when it became available. And of course, if you drive through that campus now, you couldn't believe what it used to be. It was, in fact, the center of the African-American culture and community in Indianapolis. Indiana Avenue that runs through the middle of the area was the scene of many jazz locations and bars and entertainment venues of one kind or another. And as I said, the housing around it was all African-American. The only public housing project to that date was in that as well. And so that's kind of how IUPUI came about.
We're talking with former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz and historian Ted Frantz on the new memoir, An Examined Life, The John Mutz Story. So, Ted, I mean, as a historian yourself, what was it like digging into this very specific but significant history on the city that you live in?
Well, it was absolutely essential. And until we wrote this book, I don't think there really was a good account of how the origins of UniGov and how it got passed. And so I think that that's a really significant accomplishment of this book in addition to, documenting John's life. And so, many of the sources to investigate both the founding of UniGov and of IUPUI, you can find those in traditional print sources, specifically newspapers. Some people had already done oral histories that I was able to access. I mean, I conducted some of my own and did some with John. But I mean, it's an incredibly rich history, an incredibly complicated history. And again, like just being able to sit down and tease out. So you were having this conversation at this point in time. And again, I work for the University of Indianapolis, and there are so many people who were involved in that initial project for IUPUI when I first got to town. And I'm not originally from the city. I'm not originally from Indiana. And they said, you know, your university stole the name. We were supposed to be the University of Indianapolis. And I have a much better appreciation for that in 2020, now that I've written this book with John, than I did in 2002 when I arrived in the city. So it's one of those great things that, again, I think is really essential about how and why the city developed. You know, John and a few others have seen it transform so dramatically and were a key part in helping that transformation take place.
Ted, we have a question from Ray on Facebook. Ray asks, while you and John Mutz speak at length about the bipartisan achievements such as IUPUI and UNIGOV, can you comment on how that history figures into the hyper-partisanship of more recent political history?
You directed it to me, so I'll try to go quickly. I think one of those things is I'm just so... my conversations with John spoiled me in so many different ways, and I appreciate the question, Ray. But I think that one of them is that compromise is a four-letter word these days, and John would remind me of that, is that compromise was inherent in everything that they did. So much of the UNIGOV legislation, for instance, was about compromise. Nobody got exactly what he or she wanted. Especially when it came to schools, that was a compromise that was made very early on. For instance, that was done to get votes from, people said at the time schooling was such a hot button issue. For instance, also about annexation of land right outside of Marion County, so that unfortunately in the future Marion County couldn't grow. It was the only county that had that restriction. Those are just two very specific examples. Really from the UNIGOV legislation about how compromise not only was a good thing, but absolutely necessary. And so I really think that would be another audience for this book, is anybody who's thinking about politics realizing it's great to be an idealist. And John talks about being a young idealist, but a young idealist in his day meant that you had dreams, but you weren't going to be so rigid that it was my way or the highway. So that would be my... brief attempt, and it wasn't that brief.
And John, as a follow-up to that, we have another question from Chad on Twitter, who asks, how has the state's political environment changed since you were lieutenant governor, and what advice would you give someone running for public office?
That's two different questions, but
sure.
To say it changed, Indiana was a toss-up state during the time period that I served in the legislature, lieutenant governor. Yeah. We switched from Democratic control to Republican control. Even the houses of the legislature were moving back and forth from one party to the other. And the number one lobbyist in Indiana was the ISTA, the Indiana State Teachers Association. They were regarded as the most influential. The second influential would be the business community through the State Chamber of Commerce. And the third would be labor unions. And that, of course, included the teachers union as well as the AFL-CIO. And they were a major influence. And their shadow, you could feel it over your shoulder when you served at that particular time, because they had lots of money and lots of members, which is not the case today. So that's a major change. The other change is that we did not at that time interrelate social behavior as much as we do now with government. And that, of course, that includes religious observance, religious practices, certain things that certain religions favor or are against in one way or another. And so the social environment wasn't quite the same. The arrival of the abortion issue took place during my tenure in the legislature. It suddenly became a major issue. And then along with that came the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment, which was designed to provide equal opportunity for women in our society. Those were the early indications of social questions. But the kind of things that are considered today are, I think, more examples of government getting involved in personal life. And we stayed clear of those by and large during that time period. So those are two of the major differences that I would cite, the impact of the different groups and also the emphasis on social issues. Now, the second thing was, what would I say to somebody who wants to run for office today?
In about 30 seconds, yeah.
All right. Okay.
There you go.
I'm saying there aren't many people who ask me, but those who do, and particularly the young ones, I say, get a good job. Learn what it's like to be in the private sector. Mm. Learn what it's like to acquire a little personal equity. Because if you run for office or if you serve other people who are in office, you're not going to win all the time. You may lose. And it's good to have something to fall back on. That's my advice.
We'll be back after a quick break. We have with us former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz and his co-author, historian Ted Frantz, talking about the new memoir, An Examined Life, The John Mutz Story. If you have questions or comments for us today, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. You can also use our new app, All in Vox Pop. Get it wherever you get apps. I'm Matt Pelser. We are back with more in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our show on the memoir, An Examined Life, The John Mutz Story, with former Lieutenant Governor John Mutz and his co-author, historian Ted Frantz from the University of Indianapolis. And as always, we would love your questions and comments for the program. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. So, John, we're finally to the point where we can talk about your tenure as lieutenant governor back in the 80s. That was a tough time. Can you just give us an idea of what you were dealing with then? What had the late 70s meant for the economy?
In the late 70s, we saw drastic changes in the economy of the United States and in Indiana in particular because of our heavy dependence on manufacturing and in the auto industry particularly. And the result was that there was a major recession taking place during the turn of that decade, that is, from the year of our election in 1980 and then inauguration in 1981. So when I took office with Governor Bob Orr, we found Indiana dealing with double-digit inflation, double-digit unemployment, and a variety of situations in which Hoosiers were afraid because they saw the Japanese taking their jobs indirectly because the auto industry was now challenged by the Japanese industry. They had developed smaller cars that were gas efficient, and this was also the era of gas shortages, lines at service stations to buy fuel, all kinds of things that we don't think much about today. And tremendous unemployment. We had double-digit unemployment then, too. So the problem we faced was, well, first of all, how do you give people hope? And we found that we couldn't give anybody a job. We couldn't even suggest where the next job might come from. So what we did was we convinced local communities throughout the state to begin local development corporations. And this was a organization of local organizations, that is, political and nonprofit and for-profit. And they gathered together to assess the future of their community from an economic standpoint. They were supposed to talk about the good things, the pluses and the minuses, and then to develop an agenda for taking care of the minuses. And this process had already started to some extent when we took office. There were six of these local development corporations in 1980 when we took office. But when we left office, there were over 124 of them. And we went around the state, talked to these people, provided some seed grants of small amounts of money, to get them started. And in almost every community, the Chamber of Commerce, the labor unions, the nonprofit community in the form of religion, as well as the politicians, all gathered together to talk about their future. Well, then the question was, where are we going to get the new jobs that we're preparing for? And like bank robbers, we decided that we would go where the money was. And the money at that time was in the hands of Japanese manufacturers. It was the one part of the international economy that seemed to be pretty flush with cash and interested in expanding their markets. So we opened offices in Tokyo, manned by both Japanese-speaking individuals as well as some Americans. And we began the process of encouraging reverse investment, that is, getting Japanese companies to come to Indiana and manufacture or do whatever it is they were making money from. At the same time, we then encouraged our own manufacturers to learn how to export. And this same office in Tokyo had a section which provided assistance to Indiana companies who wanted to sell their product in that market. So we, in essence, said the international economy is where these new jobs are going to come from, and the Japanese were the major target. Now, I'd have to say, in retrospect, this looks like a good strategy. That, of course, is a modest comment on my part, but what I'm saying is there were six Japanese investments in Indiana when we took office, and when we left office, there were 64, and today there are over 124. And there are more than 64,000 Hoosiers employed in Japanese-owned companies. I don't know what we'd do in Indiana if we didn't have that addition to the Indiana economy. Now, the Japanese were not an easy mark. They're very careful. They believe intensely in trust. And on top of that, the citizenry of Indiana wasn't too happy with the Japanese because they still remembered the Second World War. And a number of the men and women who were involved in that conflict were still alive and active in the community. So it was a major decision to seek out Japanese investment, but that's what we did, and it apparently worked. We have more Japanese involvement in Indiana than any other state in the union on a per capita basis, and more Japanese plants than any state except California in real numbers. That's the kind of thing that we did to deal with the economy that we found in the early 1980s, and that process has continued since. So that was our approach.
Those decisions, though, then kind of came back to haunt you in your bid for governor in 1988. How did Evan Bay turn that against you?
Well, the fact is that Evan did a lot of research, and they did focus groups just like we did, and we knew we were vulnerable from that standpoint. But I would still do it again, even though it was one of the major issues in the campaign against Evan in 1988. He ran numerous commercials with pictures of Japanese aircraft zipping around the air, pictures of Japanese workers working in certain locations. The fact was there were no Japanese plants with more than 3 to 5 Japanese people working there. Everybody else were Americans who were from our state. But the image was that we couldn't defeat the Japanese couldn't defeat us in the Second World War, but now they can take us over economically. That was the kind of image that was presented. And I'm convinced it did have a major impact in the campaign of 1988. Although I would say the residence of Evan Bay also was a major question as well. We have a chapter in the book that analyzes these things and talks about what we might have done differently. But I don't regret the Japanese investment strategy. It's been good for Indiana, and I think it was good for me as a human being.
Ted, we're getting into some real macro level stuff on the economy and how the world is affecting Indiana. When it came to co-writing this, what was your role in kind of distilling all of this down for a common reader?
Given my background in economics, which is next to zero, and given my dealing with high finance as a professor, I was actually the perfect one to translate that in some ways. Now, seriously, the tools of the humanities allow us to help do that. And this was definitely one of those. There's so much in this project where I had to learn in order to even begin to be conversant with John on a number of topics, whether it was philanthropy or economics. And the fact of the matter is, I guess, on the Japanese investment strategy, there are a lot of, you know, little details that you can get into, like the first plant that actually was here wasn't autos. It was manufacturing CDs when that was the cutting edge technology. But that was my youth. And so, I mean, I can remember, for instance, the kind of fear of Japanese taking over. It was pervasive in a lot of the movies, even comedies from the 1980s. So in some ways, it's just being able to fact check and distill down. And again, that's what John would agree to. We would check things. And one of the great things is John still has so many loyal former employees who are helpful in connections, not only here in Indianapolis and in Indiana, but across the world. And so that helped us tremendously with source material as well.
Well, John, let's talk a little more about that 1988 campaign for governor. I mean, we heard a little bit about some of the arrows in your quiver against Evan Bayh. And as I understand it, one of the sources for that chapter was the current mayor of Indianapolis, Joe Hogsett. What had he written about that election?
Well, Joe was one of Evan's people. He worked with him in the campaign. I'm not sure what you're referencing there. Are you asking me what did Joe think or what?
Well, I thought that he had written a comprehensive history of the 1988 gubernatorial election. I could be mistaken, though.
Could I jump in there, Matt, real fast?
Like, please,
that is
Tim.
That is one of those. John has the firsthand experience and have all of those. But yeah, that was what Joe Hogsett wrote a master's thesis at IUPUI. All roads lead back to John Mutz on that election. And so he had combed through a lot of the newspapers of the time and some of the legal challenges. So that provided something for me. I mean, that's not a published account. You can find it on the internet pretty easily. But of course, that was fascinating to have that connection as well. Sorry to jump in there, John, but
no, that's fine. I remember that Joe wrote about it, but to be candid with you, I can't remember many of the details that he wrote.
Well, and John, I mean, that was a close election, 1988. I mean, did it ever cross your mind to run again, or was that it at that point?
It did cross my mind to run again, and I had a number of colleagues who worked with me during my 8 years in office who encouraged it. All in all, though, I decided that the things that happened to me as a result of the defeat were things that most people would give their left arm to do. I mean, here I was, a defeated candidate, yes, disappointed, hurt to some extent, yes, I agree to all that, but suddenly I became the president of Lilly Endowment.
Mm-hmm.
That is an unusual experience in and of itself, and it's a chance to be on the inside of the development of central Indiana and Indianapolis in a way that almost no one else can be. Then that was followed by being president of PSI Energy, the largest electric utility in the state of Indiana. And that was fun, too. I mean, you know, I had over 1,200, I'm sorry, a little over 2,400 employees who reported to me. And I had a chance to learn about electricity, which I knew very little about when I took the job. But I learned a lot in that regard. And then that was followed by an opportunity to head up a brand new foundation in Indianapolis, and that is the Lumina Foundation, which is devoted to higher education, post-high school activities. And I became board chairman of that. I had an opportunity to see that develop and grow. And so, you know, that's an unbelievable chance for anybody, any one of those three things.
And John, at the end of this book, in our last few minutes, I want to make sure we get to this. There's kind of a reflective chapter on the philosophy of living life, this idea of working hard in the first half or more of life and then how to enjoy the rest. What did you explore in that one?
Well, the last chapter is entitled Finding Meaning in the Second Half of Life. The reference to the second half of life really comes from the reading that my wife, Carolyn, and I do from the one of the original members of our psychology industry today, Carl Jung. And Carl Jung said that in the first half of life, you do your best to find your place in the world. You develop your skills. You develop your contacts. And you kind of decide where you want to go from a personal standpoint. But in the second half of life is when you actually find meaning. And so I decided in that part of the book to talk about where Carolyn and I have been trying to find meaning. And of course, this includes a variety of pretty obvious things. For example, would be enhancing and improving your relationship with your children and your grandchildren. And I've been in the unbelievable position of being able to watch my children grow up and become adults and build their own lives. And now my grandchildren are old enough that I can see them doing the same thing. That is an unbelievable opportunity. Now, one of the other things, of course, you look at the second half of life, well, what really are you excited about? What turns you on, if you want to call it, use that term? And so one of the things that I've done in that respect is we've looked at other things that we'd like to improve. And one of those is local news coverage in the United States. Because of the economics of the internet society, the way we collect and disseminate news is changing. It's dramatically changing. And there are a number of areas of the country now that have what they call news deserts, meaning there's nobody at the local level who reports on the school board, the local nonprofits, the mayor, all that sort of thing. And so I've gotten involved with the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern in putting together a local news initiative. And the idea here is to find a style and a model for how you run a local news operation and make money at it. So those are examples of the second half of life.
Well, I want to thank our guests for taking the time today. John Mutz was Lieutenant Governor of Indiana under Robert Orr from 1981 to 1989, and he's the author of the memoir An Examined Life, The John Mutz Story. John Mutz, thanks for your time today.
It's been my pleasure.
Ted Frantz is John's co-author. He's also a historian and chair of the Department of History and Political Science at the University of Indianapolis. Thanks to you, Ted.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And a quick note, if you're interested, you can find the book on Amazon or you can buy it straight from the Indiana Historical Society. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. Our podcast can be found wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll look at what Indiana schools are facing as COVID-19 numbers continue to rise and many classrooms go all virtual. In the meantime, find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.